You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey, honorary Newfoundlanders. Welcome back to Conversations From Away. My name is Aaron Michael Ray, and we are jumping right back into episode 4, part 2. At the end of part 1 of this episode, we left off discussing gentrification and housing discrimination. So let's get right back to it. I did want to ask for everyone, have you ever been a minority in your neighborhood? And if so, what was that like for you?
I certainly have here in the South Bronx, but that was one of the reasons that I moved here. It was that I wanted to have that experience and know what that felt like. I don't know if I ever had been the only white person in a room before moving here. It's opened my eyes to a lot of things. I grew up in the city of Chicago, not the suburbs, and so I had an upbringing that had I was around a lot of diversity, but, you know, as things often are in the States, you know, there are lines that are difficult to cross sometimes. And I kind of made it a point after finishing college, both Sam and I went to Sarah Lawrence College, which is how we knew each other. And after graduating, I was looking for an apartment in New York City, and I came here because I could afford to rent here, and it was interesting to me, and I have had a great experience. I'm a runner, and I have often, for years, I've been running around the Bronx, all over the Bronx, everywhere from, you know, down around Mott Haven to up to Van Cortlandt Park to East Tremont, like Westchester Square. Like, I go everywhere, and I'm often, you know, pretty much, you know, the only white person visible for, you know, any number of distance or any amount of distance around me. And, you know, oftentimes, like, little kids used to run beside me, like, they'll, you know, kind of follow me. Just it's fun, you know, for them, and fun for me to, like, get chased by the kids in this very playful way. I've had people, you know, say to me, jokingly, you know, say things like, "Hey, it's the running white guy," you know. And like, there's always this really, there's always this sort of good naturedness to it. If anybody has anything negative to think or say to me, not that it hasn't happened, but more often than not, that's not the case. People here have been very welcoming. And, you know, where I live, I live on Findlay Avenue, just below Claremont Park. And, you know, I know most, if not many, of my neighbors on this block. And, you know, people say, it's the sort of place where people say hello in passing. It's almost like living, you know, in a small town or in the suburbs. You know, like, people say hello, even if you don't know each other. You say, "Hi, have a nice evening," you know. And and people treat me, probably do treat me a little bit differently, I'm sure. But there is overall a sense of welcome and openness, which often I have not found in white neighborhoods. Like, where I grew up in Chicago, there's more of a feeling of coldness. Like, you know, you don't really get to know your neighbors that much. And I know a lot of people say the same about, you know, places they've lived in Manhattan that are predominantly white. So anyway, you know, not to, like, just paint an absolutely rosy picture of everything. You know, there are problems, of course, as there are anywhere. But my experience here being a rare white person in a non-white neighborhood has been very positive.
I'll just add that shortly after Isaac and I graduated, my first job out of college was at the Bronx Botanical Gardens. So I also lived I think we lived five blocks away from each other, but didn't realize it until afterward.
Yeah, you were on 167th.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Okay, yeah, I was on 165th.
So we were right there. I just want to add that I also got the most amazing thing shouted at me during that time. People like to shout famous white people at me.
I used to get Forrest Gump a lot.
Got Forrest Gump. I got Tony Hawk. Kid Rock.
I used to get Robert Plant, actually. People, yeah, because I had a lot of hair.
One, I got Where's Waldo one night. That guy.
That's great.
That is ruthless, and I love that.
I lived for 3 years in Quebec, in Canada, and I was certainly a very visible minority, how they call them, how they called us there, minorité visible. And it was both really, really, really depressing because of the loneliness that I felt at times. At the same time, it really forced me, just as a matter of survival, to connect with other people that were going through the same thing. And we weren't that much liked in Quebec City because it's the cradle of Quebecois nationalism, and the university professors and so on and so forth. It wasn't really too welcoming a place. At the same time, it was commiserating with others and making friends with native people in Canada and with Haitian people and people from all over the Maghreb that lived there. At the end of the 3 years, I realized that I had a beautiful community around me, and so the other thing was that we lived in the main street of a gay life, and that was particularly awesome because the bars were open. It was crazy, so that I liked, but at times it was really depressing also because you feel lonely, you know, particularly if people don't want you there. So
I am originally from San Antonio, Texas, and I moved around a lot now that I think about it, but it didn't feel like a lot because we always stayed within the same area. And I would say that, you know, where I was living in particular was predominantly white, and it was, you know, when I was going home, I went home in quarantines when we were shut down from the pandemic. We were already in Texas, and so I just drove to San Antonio, where I quarantined for 4 months before coming to New York. And when I was there, I just remembered, hearing about the case about Ahmaud Arbery and how he was running in his neighborhood and was killed. And you know, I was kind of in this groove, and I was just working on my own fitness and everything, and I was running at least 2 to 3 times a week or something like that. And then, you know, that happened, and that was a real moment for me of okay, I can't get too comfortable even in my own neighborhood. And it was a moment where I just kind of had to really think about okay, well, if I really want to go running again, and I'm one of the only, and our family is one of, the only Black families, in our own community, then, I have to be extra careful because I'm a 6'3" big Black man, And so no matter how many times I smile or how many times, I kind of up that energy and, you know, present that to people, like, I still can come off intimidating to most people just because of that. And so when you're in a neighborhood as a person of color that is predominantly white, you are always thinking about those things. And it does get lonely, you know, because you're not surrounded by people who look like you or who really understand you, like, right away. So I absolutely relate to that. But I also love how all of, for those who have talked about, you know, being a minority in your own neighborhood, that it's all been different experiences. So I am really glad that we were all able to share on that.
I just want to add that that is something that I thought, you know, and I believe we talked about this in one of our preliminary discussions, that I have noted that, you know, my experience being a runner in a predominantly Black and Latino community is very different than what the opposite would likely be. And I've often thought of that and thought that that is very, like, how would it be to be, you know, a young Black man running through a white suburb? The response from my neighbors might not be so friendly as it has been here to me. So, sorry, I just wanted to add that.
I have a question. To go back to the book, like, very disciplinarian. So when I read something like that book, and I look at the carceral state or the so-called criminal justice problem in a place like this here in the South Bronx, like, for me, the conclusion is unmistakable and clear. The government has been our enemy. It has been, like, before we were screwed up here by private developers and the type of gentrification that we all know and we were talking about, like, the people who were dumping on this neighborhood and screwing us up was the government, was elected officials and city people, you know? And so I'm wondering how that fact can be squared with this leftist belief, you know, that government will be part of the solution, or government can make it right, you know, which I also think that's the way. Like, I don't want to get away from that, but I wonder how all of you somehow, you know, if you had that kind of cognitive dissonance, like, that the government is really the people who screw us.
Well, I just remember something we talked about in one of our meetings before this episode was, I remember bringing this up and almost kind of, like, wanting to eat my words when I say this, but at the same time, it is what it is. I remember just saying, you know, a story of racism in America is old news at this point. You know, it's like, because of how this country was already built, you know, any other story, whether it's about this topic of gentrification or housing discrimination or just any other kind of situation, it somehow comes back to how we're rooted in racism within our government. And so I think the people who are saying, you know, oh, well, the government is helping us or they're trying to help us, I wouldn't be surprised if most of those people were white, because the government, our American government, has been set up to help white people and white people only. So, you know, I think that's probably why I would assume that some people would say that. But I think it can, at the same time with that, it can absolutely be changed. I think that, you know, when you have more people, you know, not to get too political, but this is at the same time a little bit of a political, you know, discussion, you know, but not to get too political, but, you know, I think once we really see those changes within our federal government or local government or state government of, like, having more people who look like us represent us, then, you know, then we'll actually feel like we're being protected.
Yeah, because otherwise, I mean, I don't want to get depressing here, but we're talking about major systemic change. Like, we're talking about, again, as someone who has only lived in America the last few years, so I'm still learning all the systems myself, but like it blew my mind, the whole redlining history. And it blows my mind that property taxes fund schools. So that's how you get this incredible disparity between good neighborhoods and other neighborhoods, and how people are running around like crazy people trying to get into the good neighborhoods so their kids can go to a decent school. And that all is entirely attached to real estate. And therefore, you've got white enclaves and lack of, and people getting very upset if suddenly a Hispanic community are going to infiltrate the school and all of that stuff, which, like, all of that is really mind-boggling to me. And how do we begin to dismantle so many bad systems, in my opinion?
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that.
The word you used, infiltrate, was used so many times in the book, quoted in the book, but they were in actual government policies, using the word about African Americans or other undesirables infiltrating neighborhoods. And that made my skin crawl. One of the things we also talked about was, I think it was in the book, saying, if you are a homeowner, go back and if you can, get a hold of your original deed of your home and see if it has some of the covenants and exclusionary clauses in there that actually say that kind of stuff, that, you know, people of color, this house will not be sold to people of color.
Yeah, I was actually just reading about those restricted covenants today from the book, and how, you know, there are still deeds out there that say, you know, you cannot sell or resell this house to a black person, you can, or even Irish people, you know, like there are so many things, so many deeds that are still out there that say that. And I just find that very mind boggling.
Yeah, the reason that it really shook me is that, you know, we recently moved out of the city. And so we actually, my wife and my little guy bought a house. And so I was like, I would love now to get a hold of the original deed. I have to go to the county to get that and try to read it and see if it has some of those clauses in there. But it also makes me wonder, having moved from where I did into the neighborhood that I'm in now, did I contribute to any of, I don't think my move out here would be a gentrification, but did I contribute in any way to housing discrimination because of the school district that we selected for my six-year-old? It kind of makes me go, I have a lot of reckoning to deal with and a lot of research, continued research to do.
All right, honorary Newfoundlanders, we'll be right back. It's so amazing how with this topic alone that, you know, you, and the book has definitely spelled it out in an amazing way of how, you know, you think you really know enough about this topic or gentrification, and then when you really dig deeper and deeper and go further back in history, you just see that it is so, it all goes back to how it's just rooted within our government to help, you know, white people live where they want to live. So that has been very eye-opening about this book.
And sometimes, Aaron, where they didn't even want to live. They were in earlier times, they were in integrated neighborhoods, and then the government forced them apart.
That's something that, you know, that it was, this book has, I'm sorry, we keep going back to the book, The Color of Law. I'm sorry to keep doing that. And I'd be curious to hear, you know, what Sam has to say on all this as well, but, it might be, for anyone who might be watching this also, it is really fascinating to go back and read a source like this, because it's very easy to just look around and see, you know, that, oh, there are black neighborhoods that are not doing so well and white neighborhoods that are doing pretty well. And, you know, it's very easy to just assume that that's, as you said, that that's natural. And maybe it was Mancho, I can't remember who said it, but this book makes a very convincing argument for, basically spells it out that this was designed this way. This was made this way by the government during the course of hundreds of years, but especially the mid 20th century.
I think it's important to think about why, though, right? Why would the government policy reinforce segregation in the way that it did? And it, calls to mind a passage in an essay by historian Barbara Fields, who's writing about slavery in the U.S., and she says it's not like the product of slavery was white supremacy. We didn't create the system of transatlantic slavery in order to produce white supremacy. White supremacy was a tool to produce cheap cotton. That was the product that was there to make a profit. And the horrible, immoral system of transatlantic slavery, which had devastating impacts for the entire world, was essentially a scheme to make a very cheap commodity which could be sold worldwide. So then the question is, what was supposed to be the product of racial segregation, if that was also a policy of the US government? And I would argue that the product was profit from housing. And that, you know, the real estate industry, this wouldn't have happened if the real estate industry wasn't interested and able to exploit the difference between what white people could have, what they could profit from, what they could gain equity from, and what people who are excluded from that system, predominantly African Americans, but also some people we now call white people. And you know, there's a lot of profit to be made off of keeping them out of the system, right? The housing costs are actually higher for the people who are excluded from the system than they are for the people who buy into it. So I think it's important to show, you know, how money is made off of all these things as one of the main, if not the only, but certainly one of the main explanatory factors for why does the government do this over and over again throughout this history. And then I think that brings it back to the question Moncho asked, which is, if the government has been the enemy this whole time, then why would we expect the government to do anything different? It's a perfectly valid question, except who else is going to do it? Who else has the power to remake systems, right? Certainly, I don't trust the real estate industry to do it. I don't trust the market. And it, you know, a simplistic way of viewing society is basically you got market, you got capital, you've got the government, the state, and you've got us, the people, labor, whatever you want to call us. And so it's up to the people to kind of remake the state as the entity that could really change all these things. That's my little case for revolution.
We the people.
You see troublemakers everywhere.
But he's making good trouble, so I like
that.
Oh,
yes, yes. But Sam, sometimes what I wonder is that, so yes, like, today we can see the market or capitalism and the state, like, and that's it. And I go back to back in history, I'm like, so it is not that I want that to happen, but for example, before in history we had religious life, you know, like religious as an organizing factor that could give you solace or actually liberate you from certain, you know, crap that was happening. And I wonder if just concentrating in that, I mean, to be fair, you also mentioned that it's us. There is us. So there is capitalism, there is us, and there is the state. If we need more imagination, more political imagination, in terms of imagining how we are gonna come out of this predicament, because at the same time, one of the things that my reading and my research has led me to see is how the very, as you said, the very constitution of the modern world is predicated in this kind of racism, because it was a scheme to sell cheap crap, you know, and to produce it as cheaply as possible. And so our world is defined by that. Our ideas of government are defined by that. The very notion of our contemporary understanding, for example, of sovereignty and liberalism and democracy as we practice it today, in what we could recognizably call democracy, all of that came to be much or less at the same time of black, anti-black racism, you know? And so I wonder, like, is it possible to really just take over the government and do something really substantial about this? Or do we need to imagine something different as a way, as an energy creator, to actually bust the situation or the chains we find ourselves in. Like, I, long story short, I don't trust the government. I don't trust the market. I don't trust religion. I have a little bit more trust in us, but not too much. So I always, the what it will be, like, remains to be seen for me.
I just feel like everything you said, I just can only receive and really kind of, I want to, like, take it home and just, you know, marinate on that, if you will. Sam and Macho, I also want to take a moment to say how I'm just glad that y'all are here, because, you know, your expertise on all of this is so eye-opening and so amazing for all of us, and especially the viewers who are watching this. So I wanted to ask both of you, could y'all tell us more about the work, Sam, that you do for the Community Service Society of New York and Mancho for the South Bronx Unite? And what has been the most rewarding part about the work you do? You can start with Sam.
Sure. I started this work about 6 months ago, right in the heart of this pandemic. Wow. Which is tough. And I started it, I took the position of a friend of mine who died of COVID in April. So carrying on his legacy is very important to me. Community Service Society is an organization that has kind of a social service arm that helps people who are in trouble, who are in poverty, who are struggling with eviction or trying to expunge their criminal records to get a job, and does other kind of important direct service work. My work there is in rethinking housing policy. And the most rewarding part of it is being a resource to community-based organizations that need the skills of someone who can, who knows the history of housing policy in the US and in New York City, who can find the data and try to help make the argument for change. So that's been the most rewarding part so far.
So yes, I am a volunteer in South Bronx United. None of us gets paid. So the work that we do, I think it transitioned from what I find the fun part of protesting and being annoying to those in power, which is what I love to do, you know, disrupting stuff, to actually proposing concrete projects and ideas. And so that's where the land trust, the community land trust, you know, factors in. And so we began as a environmental justice organization. That now has coagulated, you know, like it's a positive political project around the idea of the community land trust. There are a few very, very fulfilling occasions, have been many fulfilling occasions to the work that we do. For example, when you are a environmental justice organization, and suddenly people that, neighbors that want support in immigration matters come to us and ask you to be part of the network, you know, of immigration support. That was really flattering, and it really made it feel that all the stuff that we've been doing with the environment, like was super extra worth it. And there was another moment when City Hall realized that the cop that murdered Eric Garner wasn't gonna be charged. South Bronx United got a call from City Hall asking us to be agents in the pacification of the neighborhood, because obviously we're Puerto Rican and Black, so they obviously assumed that we're gonna blow shit up. I'm sorry. And so they called us. And that was really, really, really also satisfying, because obviously the answer was no, we're not gonna do it. But then we also realized, like, these people are scared. And the fact that they're calling us means that they think that we have power. And so I think that was also something that really showed us, you know, that told us, like, yeah, we're doing something right.
I love that. Thank you both for sharing that. It really, I can't express how much that the work that both of y'all do is so great and it should be celebrated. And I'm just really proud to know both of you. So thank you for sharing that.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. For the viewers out there that want to read more on what we talked about in this episode, like we said, a lot of our research has been based off of The Color of Law and by Richard Rothstein. It goes to excruciating detail about how all things our government has tried and still tries to do to segregate America. So very, very eye-opening. And I highly recommend. So at the end of each episode, we always like to shout out a Black-owned organization or business. And this week, we are shouting out the Harlem Candle Company. Nothing feels cozier than these candles from Harlem Candle Company. I selfishly wanted to shout them out. I have no ties to them at all or anything. I'm just currently obsessed with their candles, mainly because they're all based off of, all the candles are named after, you know, jazz artists like the Ellington and the Billie Holiday. Like, it's just great. That wraps up our episode. So thank you to our fabulous Come From Away panelists for joining me this week. And a special thanks to Sam and Mancho for your knowledge and presence. So thank you all very much and stay safe.
Bye. Bye.
All right, honorary Newfoundlanders, thank you so much for tuning in to episode 4, part 2. A portion of our ad revenue will be going to South Bronx Unite and Community Service Society of New York. We thank you once again for listening. Stay safe out there, and we'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
Life's better with American Family Insurance. Because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.